away from the sides of the steps. He kept the snow scraped down to the ground and the concrete and never allowed it to accumulate. When there was no new snow and only the glare of ice, he hacked away with a lethal ice chipper. During the time when everything melted, but the ground could not yet be prepared for the garden, he again ate constantly, putting back the flesh he'd lost to his winter war. Spring and summer involved weeds that grew with vicious alacrity, pilfering animals, bugs, vicissitudes of weather. He used the pushmore the way most his age would use a walker, but incidentally clipping the yard down to the nub. He tended a large vegetable garden with invisible zeal, rooting out quack grass, pigweed, and hauling bucket loads of water for the squash hills, again without ever seeming to move. He didn't care much for the flower garden, but Clements had a raspberry patch gone wild that mingled with a stand of juneberry bushes. When the berries began to ripen, Mushum rose at dawn to defend them. A living scarecrow, he sat in his yellow chair, sipping his morning tea. To frighten off the birds, he'd also rigged up a clothesline of tin can lids. He pierced the can tops with a hammer and nail, and knotted them close enough to clatter in a breeze. He secured these jangling lines all about the garden, and I was always very careful to note where he hung them, as the edges of the cans were sharp, and a boy who bicycled through the yard too carelessly might have his throat cut. By means of this ceaseless and seemingly quixotic activity, Mushum stayed alive. When he was past the age of 90 years, cataracts were removed from his eyes and false teeth refitted to his shriveled gums. His ears were still keen. He heard so well that he was bothered by the periodic judder of Clements's sewing machine down the hall, and by my Uncle Edward's habit of humming dirges while he corrected school papers. One morning in June heat, I rode to their house. He heard my bicycle while I was still on the main road, but then I'd clothespin a playing card to a spoke. I liked the cheerful clatter, and also the ace of diamonds was good luck. Anybody might have heard me, but no one would have been so happy at that moment to see me as Mushum, for he had tangled himself in a large piece of bird netting that he had been attempting to throw over the high bush pembina berries, even though they were nowhere near ripe. I leaned my bike against the house and untangled him. Then I folded the net back up. I asked him where my auntie was and why he'd been left alone, but he hushed me and said she was inside the house. She don't like me to use the net. The birds get tangled up and die in it, or lose their feet. Indeed, from the folds of the net, at that moment, I picked out a tiny bird's leg, its minute claw still clenched around the strand of plastic webbing. I undid it carefully and showed it to Mushum, who peered at it and worked his mouth back and forth. "Let me hide that," he said. "I'm keeping it." I put the claw in my pocket. "I won't tell Clements. Maybe it's got luck in it." "You need some luck?" We put the net away in the garage and walked to the back door. The day was heating up, and it was almost time for Mushum to take his morning nap. "Yes, I need luck," I said to Mushum. "You know how things are. My father had grounded me for 3 days after I biked off without leaving a note. I'd been at home with my mother all that time. And there was still the ghost I'd never had a chance to figure out. I wanted to ask Mushum what it meant." Mushum's eyes watered, but not from pity. The sun was beginning to glare. He needed the Ray-Ban sunglasses that Uncle Whitey had given him for his last birthday. He took out a balled-up and faded bandana and touched a rag to his cheekbones. Strings of hair hung around his face. "There's better ways of getting luck than from a bird's leg," he said. We went inside. My aunt, who was dressed to go out and clean the church, in a set of high heels, a ruffled white shirt and tight, streaky jeans, immediately put a pitcher of iced tea and 2 glasses on the table. I wanted to laugh and ask how she was going to clean church in heels. But she saw me looking at them and said, "I take them off, wrap my feet in rags, and polish the floor."
"What's this?" Mushin pursed his mouth in displeasure.
"The same medicine tea you drink every single day, Daddy." Everyone around Mushin was taking credit for his longevity, and the fact that he still had his wits about him.
"Or what passed for wits," Clement said when he angered her.
His next birthday was coming up, and Mushin claimed he would be 112. Clements was focused especially hard on keeping him alive so that he could enjoy his party. She was making big preparations. "Pour me some of that cold slew water," Mushin said to me as we sat. "Daddy, this peps you up." "I don't need no more pep. I need a place to put my pep. How about Grandma Ignatia?"
"I want to get him going.
She's all dried out." "She's younger than you," said Clements in a frosty voice. "You old buggers think you're made for young women. That's what's wrong with you. That's what's keeping me alive. That and my hair."
Mushin touched the long, slick, scrawny white mane he'd been growing for years. Clements kept trying to braid or tie Mushim's hair back, but he preferred to let it corset in matting strings down the sides of his face.
"Oy, aye." He took a big gulp of tea. "If Louis Riel had let Dumont ambush the militia back then, I'd be a retired prime minister. Clements here might be governing our Indian nation instead of wiping the priest's floor. She'd have no time to make me drink these endless buckets of twig juice. The stuff runs right through me, my boy. Oops. Ha ha. That's what I'll say when I shit my pants. Oops."
"Don't you dare," said Clements. "Stay with him till I get back and make sure he gets to the toilet, him. She said she'd be back by noon or one." I nodded and drank the tea. It had the sharp taste of bark. With Clements gone, we could get down to business. I needed to find out about the ghost, first of all. Then I needed luck. I asked Mushin about the ghost and described it. I told him that the same ghost had come to Randall.
"It's not a ghost, then," Mushin said. "What is it, then?" "Someone's thrown their spirit at you. Somebody that you'll see."
"Could it be the man?"
"What man?"
I took a breath.
"Who hurt my mother?"
Mushin nodded and sat motionless, frowning.
"No, probably not," he said at last. "When somebody throws their spirit at you, they don't even know it, but they mean to help."
For weeks, Mon Père dreamed that horse trampled him.
"Twice. I saw the angel that came to take my Junet. Be careful."
"Then help me get my luck," I said. "How should I start?"
"You go to your Durham first," Mushin answered. "Find the Aja Jock. My father and his father were ceremonially taken into the Crane Clan, or Ajijak. They were supposed to be leaders and have good voices. But beyond that, I'd been given no special knowledge." I told this to Mushin.
"That's okay. You just go straight to your Durham and watch. It will show you the luck, Joe."
He drank the tea, made a face. Then his head tipped down on his chest, and he fell into the instant sleep of the ancient and the very young. I helped him stand up, and with his eyes shut, he was willing to be led to the cot in the living room, where he dozed in the daytime, right beside the picture window. It was placed so that when he woke up, he could gaze at the hot, eternal sky. When Clements came back, I left the house and biked to a slough outside of town. It was shallow all along the edges, and I'd seen a heron there last time I went. All the herons and cranes and other shorebirds were my dudamok, my luck. There was a dock of gray boards, some missing. I lay down on the warm wood, and the sun went right into my bones. I saw no herons at first. Then I realized the piece of reedy shore I was staring at had a heron hidden in its pattern. I watched that bird stand, motionless. Then, quick as genius, it had a small fish, which it carefully snapped down its gullet. The heron went back to standing still, this time on one leg. I was getting impatient for the luck to show itself. "Okay," I said. "Where's the luck?" With a flare of long, pointed wings, it vaulted into the air and flapped to the other side of the lake, where the round house was, as well as the cliff and drop-off, a place we liked to swim. The prevailing winds drove waves, junk, and scudding foam to the side of the lake. I turned around, disappointed, edged up over one of the missing boards, and looked down into the shadow of the dock through the clear water of the lake. There were usually baby perch, water skimmers, tadpoles, and maybe even a turtle to watch. This time a child's face stared up at me, startling, but I knew it was a doll right off, a plastic doll sunk wide-eyed into the lake, smirking like it had a secret, blue eyes with bits of sparkle in the iris catching points of sun. I jumped up, wheeled around, and kneeled back down for a better look. It occurred to me that if there was a toy there, might be a real child attached to it, and that child might be wedged underneath the dock. A cloud passed over the sun. I thought of going after Cappy, but finally I got too curious and looked down again, peering through the gaps between the boards. There was just the doll. A girl baby doll floating calmly along the lake bottom wearing a blue checked dress, puffy panties, and that naughty smile. As soon as I truly made sure there was no real child to go with it, I fished out the doll and shook it so the water trickled out of the seams where the head met the molded plastic body. I wrenched the head off the doll to dump out the rest of the water, and there was my luck, right there. The doll was packed with money. I pushed the head back on the doll. I looked around. All was quiet, nobody in sight. I took off the head and examined it more closely. The doll's head was stuffed with neatly rolled up bills. I was thinking $1 bills, 100, maybe 2. My pack was hanging behind my bike seat. I threw the doll in and pedaled toward the gas station. As I rode along, I thought about my luck. There was a feeling of guilt attached. I assumed that the person who'd hidden that money in a doll was a girl, maybe even somebody that I knew. She had saved up her whole life, bills scavenged here and there, little job money, birthday money, dollars from drunk uncles. Everything she had was in that doll, and she had lost it. I thought that my luck was probably temporary. There would be a pitiful ad tacked up somewhere, or even in the newspaper, a hopeless message describing this doll and asking to have it back. When I got to the gas station, I propped my bike up by the door and put the doll underneath my shirt. Sonia was taking care of a customer. I looked at the bulletin board. There were ads for bull semen and wolf puppies, offers to sell blown-out stereo equipment, hopeful snapshots and descriptions of quarter horses, pintos, and used cars. No doll. The customer finally left. I was still cradling the doll underneath my shirt. "What you got there?" Sonia asked. "Something I have to show you in private." "I've heard that one before." Sonia laughed, and I went red. "Come on in here." We went behind the counter to a tiny closet she called her office. There was a small metal desk, chair, cot, and lamp squeezed in. I took the doll from beneath my shirt. "Weird," said Sonia. I took the head off. "Holy fuck." Sonia shut the closet door. She used her long pink nails to tug the roll of bills from the neck. Then she uncurled a couple. They were $100 bills. Sonia rolled the bills back up tightly jammed them into the doll and put the head back on. She went out, shutting the door behind her, and got 3 plastic bags. Then she came back in and rolled the doll into one of the bags and wrapped another bag around that one, then used the 3rd bag as the carrier. She was looking down at me in the dim office. Her eyes were round, and their blue was dark as rain.
"Those bills are wet."
"The doll was in the lake."
"Anybody see you fish it out? Anybody see you with the doll?"
"No." Sonia took the canvas deposit pouch out of a drawer. I knew about the pouch because she took the money to the bank 2 a day. A sign at the register said, "No money on the premises." Another next to it read, "Smile, you're on candid camera." That the camera was fake was a big secret. Sonia got out the tan aluminum cash box that locked with a little key. She thought a moment. Then she took a stack of white business envelopes out of a drawer and put them in the tin box.
"Where's your dad?"
"Home."
Sonia dialed the home number and said, "Mind if I take Joe with me doing errands? We'll be back late afternoon."
"Where are we going?" I asked.
"To my house first."
We took the doll in the plastic bag, the deposit pouch, and the tan box to the car. Sonia kissed Whitey as we passed and told him that she was making a deposit and was going to buy me some clothes and stuff. The implications was that she was doing for me the things that my mother would have done if she was able to get up and out.
"Sure," said Whitey, waving us off.
Sonny always made certain that I buckled myself in and rode safe. She had an old Buick sedan that Whitey kept running, and she was a careful driver, though she smoked, flicking the ashes into a messy little pull-out ashtray. The rest of the car was vacuum spotless. We rode out of town and turned down the road to the old place, past the horses in the pasture, who looked up at us and started forward. They must have known the sound of the car. The dogs were standing at the house waiting. There were Pearl's sisters, Ball and Chain. Both were black and burning yellow eyes and patches of cottonwood brown here and there in their ruffs and tails. The male dog, Big Brother, had run off about a month before. Whitey had put a stairway and a deck on the front of the house. It was made of treated lumber that hadn't lost its sick green color yet. The house was floaty blue. Sonia said she painted it that blue because the name of the color, Lost in Space. The trim was spanking white, but the aluminum storm doors and solid core interior door were made old and battered. Inside the house was cool and dim. It smelled of pine sol and lemon polish, cigarettes and stale fried fish. There were 4 small rooms. The bedroom had a saggy double bed topped with a flowered comforter, and the window looked out on the sloping pasture and the horses. The Pinto and the Appaloosa had come close to the wire at the edge of the yard. Spook whinnied. A love sound. I followed Sonia into the bedroom, where she opened her closet. Perfume wafted out. She turned around with a clothes iron in her hand and plugged it into a wall beside the ironing board. The board was set right before the window where she could watch the horses. I sat down on the edge of the bed, took the doll's head off, and gave Sonia bill after bill. She carefully ironed each one flat and dry, testing the bottom of the iron often with her finger. They were all hundreds. At first we put 5 bills carefully in each envelope and folded down the flap, but didn't seal it, and put the envelope on the bed. Then we got low on envelopes and put 10 bills in each one. Then 20. Sonia gave me a tweezers, and I fished the last bills out of the wrists and ankles of the doll. Sonia used a flashlight to peer down the doll's neck. At last, I put the head back on. "Put it back in the bag," said Sonia. She wiped her wrist across her forehead and upper lip. Her face was covered with beads of sweat, although the heat hadn't reached inside the house yet. She flapped her arms up and down, patted her armpits. "Whew! Go out into the kitchen and get me some water. I gotta change my shirt.
I went out to the kitchen and opened the refrigerator. The well on the place sucked up sweet water. Sonya always kept a jug of it cold. I poured water into a Pabst Blue Ribbon glass. They collected beer glasses and drank it down. Then I filled it back up for Sonya. I guess I wanted her to drink out of the same glass as me, though I really wasn't thinking about that. I was thinking about how much money might be in the envelopes. I went back in, and Sonya had a fresh shirt on, pink and gray stripes that pulled wide across her chest. The shirt had a stiff white collar and a buttoned tab. She drank the water. "Woo," she said. We put the envelopes into the cash bag and put the bag in the aluminum box. Sonya went to the bathroom and brushed her hair, and so on. She didn't entirely shut the door, and I sat there in the kitchen looking at the bathroom wall. When she came out, she had on fresh lipstick, a pink that exactly matched her fingernails and the stripes on her shirt. We went out to the car. Sonya took the doll with her in the plastic bag. She locked it in the trunk. "We're going to open a bunch of college savings accounts for you," said Sonya. First we drove to Hoop Dance, and we were ushered past a teller to talk with a bank manager in the back. Sonya said that she was opening an account for me, a savings account, and we both signed printed cards while the woman typed out the passbook in my name with Sonya as a co-signer. Sonya handed over three of the envelopes, and the woman opening the account gave her a sharp look. "They sold his land," Sonya shrugged. The woman counted out the money and typed it into the passbook. She put the passbook into a little plastic envelope and gave it pointedly to me. I walked out with the passbook, and we drove to the other bank in Hoop Dance, where we did the same thing, only this time Sonya mentioned a big bingo win. "I'll say," said the bank manager. We kept going, drove to Argus. At one bank, she said I inherited money from my senile uncle. At another bank, she mentioned a racehorse. Then she went back to the bingo inn. It took all afternoon, us driving through the new grass pastures and crops just beginning to show. At a roadside rest stop, Sonya stopped and opened the trunk. She took out the doll in its plastic bag and dropped it in a trash can. After that, we stopped in the next town and got takeout burgers and French fries. Sonya wouldn't let me drink a Coke, but had some idea that orange soda was better for me. I didn't care. I was so happy to be in the car where Sonya had to watch the road, and I could glance at her breast straining at those stripes before I looked up at her face. Every time I talked to her, I looked at her breasts. I kept the cash box on my lap and stopped thinking about the money, actually, as money. But at last, when we had deposited it all and were driving toward home, I went through each of the passbooks and added the numbers up in my head. I told Sonya there was over $40,000. "It was a full-size baby doll," she said. "How come we couldn't keep out at least one bill?" I asked. Once I thought about it, I was disappointed. "Okay," said Sonya, "here's the thing. Wherever that money came from, they are going to want it back. They will kill to get it back. You know what I'm saying." "I shouldn't tell anybody, duh." "But can you do that? I've never known a guy who could keep a secret."
"I can."
"Even from your dad?"
"Sure."
"Even from Cappy?" She heard me hesitate before I answered. "They'd wail on him too," she said. "Maybe kill him. So you zip it and keep it zipped. On your mother's life." She knew what she was saying. She knew without looking that tears started in my eyes. I blinked. "Okay, I swear." "We have to bury the passbooks." We turned down a dirt road and drove until we came to the tree that people call the hanging tree, a huge oak. The sun was in its branches. There were prayer flags, strips of cloth. Red, blue, green, white, the old-time Anishinaabe colors of the directions, according to Randall. Some cloths were faded, some new. This was the tree where their ancestors were hanged.
None of the killers ever went on trial. I could see the land of their descendants, already full of row crops. Sonya took the ice scraper out of her glove compartment, and we put the passbooks in the cash box. She pushed the key into her front jeans pocket. Remember the day? It was June 17. We traced down the sun to a point on the horizon and then walked in a straight line from where the sun would set, 50 paces back into the woods. It took us what seemed like forever to scrape out a deep hole for the box, using just the ice scraper, but we got the box in and covered it up and fit the divots back on top and scattered them with leaves. Invisible, I said. We need to wash our hands, said Sonya. There was some water in the ditch. We used that. I get it about not telling anybody, I said as we drove home. But I want shoes like Cappy's. Sonya glanced over at me and almost caught me looking at the side of her breast. Yeah, she said. And how would you explain where you got the money to buy them? I'd say I had a job at the gas station. She grinned. You want one? Pleasure flooded into me so that I couldn't speak. I hadn't realized until then how much I wanted out of my house and how much I wanted to be working somewhere I could see and talk to other people. Just random people coming through. People who weren't dying right before your eyes. It frightened me to suddenly think that way. Hell yes, I said. You don't swear in the job, said Sonya. You're representing something. Okay. We drove for a few miles. I asked what I was representing. Reservation-based free market enterprise. People are watching us. Who's watching us? White people. I mean resentful ones, you know. Like those larks who own Vinland. He's been here, but he's nice to me. Like, he's not so bad. Linden? Yeah, that one. You should watch out for him, I said. She laughed. Whitey hates his guts. When I'm nice to him, he gets so jealous. How come you want to make Whitey jealous? All of a sudden, I was jealous, too. She laughed again and said that Whitey needed to get put in his place. He thinks he owns me. Oh. I was awkward, but she suddenly glanced at me sharp with a naughty smirk like the one on the doll's face. Then she looked away, still smiling with manic glee. Yeah, thinks he owns me. But he'll find out he don't, huh? Am I right? Soren Bjerke, special agent for the FBI, was an impassive, lanky Swede with wheat-colored skin and hair, a raw, skinny nose and big ears. You couldn't really see his eyes behind his glasses. They were always smudged. I think on purpose. He had a droopy, hound-like face and a modest little smile. He made few movements. There was a way he had of keeping perfectly still and watchful that reminded me of the Ajijak. His knobby hands were quiet on the kitchen table when I walked in. I stood in the doorway. My father was carrying 2 mugs of coffee to the table. I could tell I interrupted some cloud of concentration between them. My legs went weak with relief because I understood that Bjerke's visit was not about me. That Bjerke was here anyway and went back to the ex parte Crow Dog and then the Major Crimes Act of 1885. That was when the federal government first intervened in the decisions Indians made among themselves regarding restitution and punishment. The reason for Bjerke's presence continued on through that rotten year for Indians, 1953, when Congress not only decided to try termination out on us, but passed Public Law 280, which gave certain states criminal and civil jurisdiction over Indian lands within their borders. If there was one law that could be repealed or amended for Indians to this day, that would be Public Law 280. But on our particular reservation, Bjerke's presence was a statement of our toothless sovereignty. You have listened this far, and you know that I'm telling this story at a removal of time, from the summer in 1988,
when my mother refused to come down the stairs and refused to talk to Soren Bjerke.
She had lashed out at me and terrified my father. She had floated off so that we didn't know how to retrieve her. I've read that certain memories put down in agitation at a vulnerable age do not extinguish with time, but engrave ever deeper as they return and return. And yet, quite honestly, at that moment in 1988, as I looked at my father and Bjerke at our kitchen table, my brain was so stuffed with money like the head of that trash doll with manufactured mischief in her eyes. I walked past Bjerke into the living room, but then I didn't want to walk upstairs. I didn't want to walk past my mother's shut door. I didn't want to know that she was lying in there, breathing in there, and with her constant suffering sucking all the juice out of the excitement of the money. But because I did not want to walk past my mother's door, I turned and went back to the kitchen. I was hungry. I stood in the doorway, fidgeting, until the men again stopped talking. "Maybe you want a glass of milk," said my father. "Get yourself a glass of milk and sit down. Your aunt made a cake for us." A small round chocolate cake, neatly iced, was set on the counter. My father waved me to it. I carefully cut 4 pieces and put them on saucers with a fork beside. I brought 3 of the pieces to the table. I poured myself a glass of milk. "I'll take that up to your mother later on," said my father, nodding at the last piece of cake. So I sat down with the men, and I realized I had made a mistake. Now that I was sitting in their proximity, the truth would pull at me. Not the gas can truth, but when they seemed to wait for me to speak. I threw that out, nervously, asking if it could be evidence. "Yes," said Bjerke. His no-flinch gaze pierced the scum on his eyeglasses. "We'll do an affidavit, all in time, if we have a case." "Yes, sir." Well, I gathered my courage. "Maybe we should do it now, before I forget." "Is he the forgetful type?" asked Bjerke. "No," said my father. Still, I ended up talking into a little tape recorder and signing a paper. After that, there were some politely well-meant questions about what I was up to that summer, and how tall I was growing, and which sports I'd go out for in junior high school. "Wrestling," I said. They struggled to not look skeptical. "Or maybe cross-country." That seemed more believable. I could tell that both men were glad to have me there, but also fending off some large, morose silence of confusion between them that probably stemmed, now that I think back to that day and that hour, to their impasse. They were out of ideas and had no suspects and no sure leads and no help at all from my mother, who now insisted that the event itself had passed from her mind. The money was still pushing at me to talk, to reveal. "There's something," I said. I put down my fork and looked at my empty plate. I wanted another piece, this time with ice cream. At the same time, I had a sick sense of what I was about to do and thought that I might never eat again. "Something?" said my father. Bjerke wiped his lips. "There was a file," I said. Bjerke put down his napkin. My father peered at me over the rims of his eyeglasses. "Joe and I went through the files," he said to Bjerke. By way of explaining my unexpected remark, "We pulled the possible court cases where someone might have..." "Not that kind of file," I said. The two of them nodded at me patiently. Then I saw my father realize there was something he did not know in what I was about to say. He lowered his head and stared at me. That gilded octopus ticked on the wall. I took a deep breath, and when I spoke, I whispered in a childish way that I immediately found shameful, but which riveted them. "Please don't tell Mom I said this, please." "Joe," said my father. He took off his glasses and set them on the table. "Please. Joe." "All right,"
That afternoon, when Mom went to the office, there was a phone call. When she put the phone down, I could tell she was upset. Then about an hour afterward, she said she was going after a file. A week ago, I remembered about the file. So I asked her if they found the file. She said there was no file. She said that I should never mention a file. But there was a file. She went after it. That file is why this happened. I stopped talking, and my mouth hung open. We stared at one another like three dummies with crumbs on our chins. "That is not all," said my father suddenly. "That is not all you know." He leaned over the table in that way he had. He loomed. He seemed to grow. I thought about the money first, of course, but I was not about to give that up, and anyway, to speak about it now would also implicate Sonia. And I would never betray her. I tried to shrug it off. "That's it," I said. "Nothing else." But he just loomed. So I gave up a lesser secret, which is often the way we satisfy someone who knows, and knows that he knows, as my father did then.
"All right."
Virki leaned forward, too. I pushed my chair back, a little wildly. "Take it easy," said my dad. "Just tell what you know." That day we went out to the roundhouse and found the gas can. Well, we found something else there, too. Across the fence line, down by the lake shore, there was a cooler and a pile of clothes. We didn't touch the clothes.
"What about the cooler?" asked Bjerke.
"Well, I believe we opened that." "What was in it?" asked my father.
"Beer cans."
I was about to say they were empty, then I looked at my father and knew that a denial was beneath me, and a lie would embarrass both of us in front of Bjerke. "2 6-packs," I said. Bjerke and my father looked at each other, nodded, and sat back in their chairs. Just like that, I ratted out my friends in order to hide the fact of the money. I sat stunned at how quickly it had happened. I was also shocked at how perfectly my admission covered up the $40,000 I had just secured that very day with Sonia's help, or under Sonia's direction. It was me helping Sonia, after all. She was the one who had the idea. She was the one who hadn't gone to my father or to the police. She was an adult, so theoretically, she was responsible for what had happened that day. I could always take refuge in that, I thought. And that I had this idea, surprised and then humiliated me so that, sitting there before my father and Bjerke, I began to sweat, and I felt my heart quicken and my throat seize up. I jumped up. "I gotta go."
"Did he smell like beer?" I heard my father ask.
"No," said Bjerke. I locked myself in the bathroom and could hear them talking out there. If there had been a window easy to open, I might have jumped out and run. I put my hands under the water and muttered words and very deliberately did not look into the mirror. When I came back out and slunk to the table, I saw a slip of paper next to my empty cake plate and milk glass.
"Read it," said my father.
I sat down. It was a citation, though just on scrap paper. "Underage drinking. It mentioned juvenile detention. Should I cite your friends, too?"
I drank both 6-packs, I paused.
"Over time."
"Where would we find the cans?" asked Bjerke.
"They're gone, crushed up, thrown out. They were Hams." Bjerke didn't seem to think the brand was remarkable. He didn't even jot this down.
"That area was under surveillance," he said. "We knew about the cooler and the clothes, but they don't belong to the attacker. Bugger Poirier came home from Minneapolis to see his dying mother. She kicked him out, as usual, and he moved in down there. We were hoping he'd come get his beer, but I guess you drank it first." He said this in a remote but somehow sympathetic tone, and I felt my head begin to swim with the sudden drain of adrenaline. I stood up again and backed away with the paper warning in my hands.
"I'm sorry, sir.
They were hams. We thought... I kept backing up until I reached the doorway, and then I turned around. Leaden, I climbed the stairs. I went past my mother's door without looking in on her. I went into my own room and shut the door. My parents' bedroom took up the front of the upstairs and had three windows that normally let in the first sunlight of morning. The bathroom and sewing room took up small spaces on either side of the stairway. My room at the back of the house caught the lone gold of sunset, and in summer especially it was comforting to lie in my bed and watch the radiant shadows climb the walls. My walls were painted a soft yellow. My mother had painted the walls while she was pregnant, and always said she'd chosen the color because it would be right for either a girl or a boy, but that halfway through the painting she knew I was a boy. She knew because each time she worked in the room a crane flew by the window, my father's dudum, as I have said. Her own clan was the turtle. My father insisted that she had arranged for the snapping turtles she hooked on their first date to scare him into asking her to marry him without delay. I only learned later that they'd caught the very snapper whose shell my mother's first boyfriend had carved with their initials. That boy had perished. Clements had told me. The turtle's message had been about mortality, how my father should act with swiftness in the face of death. As the light crept down the sides of the walls, turning the yellow paint to a deeper bronze, I thought about the awful doll and the money. I thought about Sonia's left breast and right breast, which after continual surreptitious observation I had concluded were slightly different, and I wondered if I'd ever know exactly how. I thought about my father sitting in the welling gloom downstairs, and my mother in the black bedroom with the shades drawn against tomorrow's sunrise. There was that hush on the reservation that falls between the summer dusk and dark, before the pickup trucks drag between the bars, the dance hall, and the drive-up liquor window. Sounds were muted. A horse neighed over the trees. There was a short, angry bawl way off as a child was dragged in from outdoors. There was the drone of a faraway motor chugging down from the church on the hill. My mother hadn't ever realized that cranes are very predictable and cease their hunting at a certain hour and return to their roosts. Now the crane my mother used to watch, or its offspring, flapped slowly past my window. That evening it cast the image not of itself, but of an angel on my wall. I watched the shadow. Through some refraction of the brilliance, the wings arced up from the slender body. Then the feathers took fire, so the creature was consumed by light.
Chapter 8. Hide and Cue. My mother's job was to know everybody's secrets. The original census rolls taken in the area that became our reservation go back past 1879 and include a description of each family by tribe, often by clan, by occupation, by relationship, age, an original name in our language. Many people had adopted French or English names by that time, too, or had been baptized and received thereby the name of a Catholic saint. It was my mother's task to parse the ever more complicated branching and interbranching tangle of each bloodline. Through the generations, we have become an impenetrable undergrowth of names and liaisons. At the tip of each branch, of course, the children are found. Those newly enrolled by their parents are often a single mother or father, with a named parent on the blank whose identity, if known, might shake the branches of the other trees. Children of incest, molestation, rape, adultery, fornication beyond reservation boundaries or within, children of white farmers, bankers, nuns, BIA superintendents, police, and priests. My mother kept her files locked in a safe. No one else knew the combination of the safe, and there was now a backlog of tribal enrollment applications piled up at her office.
Special Agent Bierke was in our kitchen the next morning to approach the problem of questioning my mother about the particular file. Would it help if we had a woman to talk? We can get a female agent to drive over here from our Minneapolis office.
I don't think so. My father fiddled with the tray he'd fixed for my mother's breakfast. There was an egg fried the way she liked, toast buttered just so, a dab of Clements's raspberry jam. He had already brought her coffee with cream and was encouraged that she'd sat up for him and had a sip. I went upstairs with the tray and set it down on one of the chairs next to the bed. She had put down the coffee and was pretending to sleep. I could tell by the infinitesimal tension in her body and her fake deep breath. Perhaps she knew that Soren Bierke had returned, or perhaps my father had said something about the file already. She would feel betrayed by me. I didn't know if she would ever forgive me. And I left her room wishing that I could go straight to Sonia and Whitey's and pump gas in the hot sun, or wash windshields, or clean that scummy restroom. Anything but go back upstairs into the bedroom. My father said it was important I be there so that she couldn't deny it. "We'll have to break through her denial," is how he put it, and I felt a miserable dread. The three of us went upstairs, my father first, then Bierke, me last. My father knocked before entering her room. And Bierke, looking at his feet, waited outside with me. My father said something. "No," she cried out, and there was the crash of what I knew was the breakfast tray, a clatter of silverware skidding across the floor. My father opened the door. His face was glossy with sweat. "We'd best get this over with." And so he entered and sat down in two folding chairs he'd pulled up next to her bed. He lowered himself, like a dog that knows it isn't welcome, onto the end of the bed. My mother moved to the far edge of the mattress and lay hunched, her back to us, the pillow childishly held over her ears. "Geraldine," said my father in a low voice, "Joe's here with Bierke. Please, don't let him see you this way."
"What way?" Her voice was a crow's jeer.
"Crazy? He can take it. He's seen it. But he'd rather be with his friends. Let him go, Basil. Then I'll talk to you."
"Geraldine, he knows something. He told us something." My mother crunched herself into a smaller ball. "Mrs. Coote," said Bierke, "I apologize for bothering you again. I'd much rather solve this and let you alone, leave you in peace. But the fact is, I need some additional information from you. Last night, we learned from Joe that on the day you were attacked, you received a telephone call. Joe thinks he remembers that this telephone call was upsetting to you. He says that after a short time, you told him that you were going after a file, and then you drove to your office. Is this true?" There was no movement or sound from my mother. Bierke tried again. But she waited us out. She didn't turn to us. She didn't move. It seemed an hour that we sat in a suspense that quickly turned to disappointment and then to shame. My father finally lifted his hand and whispered, "Enough." We backed out of the room and walked down the steps. Late that afternoon, my father moved a card table into the bedroom. My mother did not react. Then he set up folding chairs at the table, and I heard her furiously berating him and begging him to take it away. He came downstairs sweating again and told me that every night at 6 o'clock I was to be home for dinner, which we'd bring upstairs and eat together. "Like a family again," he said. "We're starting this regiment now." I took a deep breath and carried up the tablecloth. Again, though my mother was angry, my father opened the shades and even a window to let in a breeze. We brought a salad and a baked chicken up the stairs, plus the plates, glasses, silverware, and a pitcher of lemonade. Perhaps a drop of wine tomorrow night,
to make something festive of it,
Dad said without hope.
He brought a bouquet of flowers he'd picked from the garden that she hadn't seen yet. He put them in a small painted vase. I looked at the green sky on the vase, the willow, the muddy water and awkwardly painted rocks.
I was to become overly familiar with this glazed scene during those dinners because I didn't want to look at my mother, propped up staring wearily at us as if she had just been shot, or rolled into a mummy pretending to be in the afterlife. My father tried to keep a conversation going every night, and when I had exhausted my meager store of the day's doings, he forged on, a lone paddler on an endless lake of silence, or maybe rowing upstream. I am sure I saw him laboring on the muddy little river painted on the vase. After he'd spoken of the day's small events one night, he said he'd had a very interesting talk with Father Travis Wozniak, and that the priest had been there in Dealey Plaza on the day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Travis's father had taken him into the city to see the Catholic president and his elegant first lady, who was wearing a suit, the exact mute pink as the inside of a cat's mouth. Travis and his father walked down Houston Street, crossed Elm, and decided that the best place to view the president would be there on the grassy slope just east of the triple underpass. They had a good view and watched the street expectantly. Just before the first motorcycle escorts appeared, someone's black and white gun dog ran out into the middle of the street and was quickly recalled by its owner. It often bothered Travis afterward to think that if only the dog had got loose at another time, perhaps, just as the motorcade passed, messing up the precision and timing of things, or if it had thrown itself under the wheels of the presidential convertible in an act of sacrifice, or leapt into the president's lap, what followed might not have happened. This so gnawed at him on some nights that he lay awake wondering just how many unknown and similarly inconsequential accidents and bits of happenstance were at this moment occurring or failing to occur in order to ensure he took his next breath, and the next. It gave him the sensation that he was tottering on the tip of a flagpole. He was poised on circumstance. He said the feeling has grown stronger and more persistent, too, since the embassy bombing where he'd been injured.
Interesting, my father said. That priest, a flagpole sitter.
Father Travis had gone on describing how the motorcycle preceded the presidential convertible, and there was John F. Kennedy, looking straight ahead. Some women sitting on the grass had brought their lunch to eat and now stood up beside their sandwich boxes and wildly clapped and cheered. They drew the president's attention, and he looked directly at them and then smiled at Travis, who was dazzled and disoriented to see the portrait in the living room of every Catholic family come to life. The shots sounded like a car had backfired. The first lady stood up, and Travis saw her scan the crowd. The car halted. Then more shots. She drew herself down, and that was the last he saw, for his father threw him down, too, and covered him with his body. He was slammed into the ground so suddenly, and his father was so heavy, that he bit into the sod. Ever after, thinking of that day, he remembers the grit in his teeth. Soon his father felt the shift of the crowd, and the two of them rose. Waves of confusion swirled, turned chaotic, when the presidential car streaked forward. People ran back and forth, not certain which direction was safest, and subject to racing rumors. He saw a family of black people cast themselves onto the earth in grief. The speckled gun dog was loose again. It trotted right and left, nose high, as if it were actually directing the crowd instead of being buffeted this way and that by surges of people in the grip of conflicting terrors and fascinations. Some tried to run back to the place they had last seen the president, and others grappled with people they thought somehow responsible. People sank to their knees and were lost in prayer or shock. The gun dog sniffed a fallen woman and then stood beside her,
pointing gravely and motionlessly at the stuffed bird on her hat. On another night, after I tried but at last grew stumped for conversation, my father remembered that, of course, an Ojibwe person's clan meant everything at one time, and no one didn't have a clan. Thus you knew your place in the world and your relationship to all other beings. The crane, the bear, the loon, the catfish, lynx, kingfisher, caribou, muskrat, all of these animals and others in various tribal divisions, including the eagle, the marten, the deer, the wolf, people were part of these clans, and were thus governed by special relationships with one another and with the animals. This was, in fact, said my father, the first system of Ojibwe law, the clan system punished and rewarded. It dictated marriages and regulated commerce. It told which animals a person could hunt and which to appease, which would have pity on the dudum or a fellow being of that clan, which would carry messages up to the Creator, over to the spirit world, down through the layers of the earth, or across the lodge to a sleeping relative. There are many instances right in our own family. In fact, as you well know, he said to the crease in the blankets that was my mother, your own great aunt was saved by a turtle. As you remember, she was of the turtle, or the Mikinak clan. At the age of 10, she was put out to fast on a small island. There she stayed one early spring, 4 days and 4 nights, with her face blackened, utterly defenseless, waiting for the spirits to become her friends and adopt her. On the 5th day, when her parents did not return, she knew something was wrong. She broke the paste of saliva that sealed her thirsty mouth, drank lake water, and ate a patch of strawberries that had tormented her. She made a fire, for although she was not allowed to use it on her fast, she carried with her flint and steel. Then she began to live on that island. She made a fish trap and lived off fish. The place was remote, but still she was surprised at how the time passed, 1 moon, 2, and no one came to get her. She knew by then that something very bad had happened. She also knew that the fish would soon retreat to another part of the lake for the summer, and she would starve. So she determined to swim to the mainland, 20 miles away. She set off on a fair morning, with the wind at her back. For a long time the waves helped her along, and she swam well enough, even though she had been weakened by her meager diet. Then the wind changed and blew directly against her. Clouds lowered, and she was lashed by a cold driving rain. Her arms and legs were heavy as swollen logs. She thought that she would die, and in her struggle called out for help. At that moment she felt something rise beneath her. It was a giant, and a very old Michigan, one of those snapping turtles science tells us are unchanged for over 150 million years. A form of life, frightful but perfect. This creature swam below her, breaking her way through the water, nudging her to the surface when her strength gave out, allowing her to cling to its shell when she was exhausted, until they came to shore. She waded out and turned to thank it. The turtle watched her silently, its eyes uncanny yellow stars, before it sank away. Then she found her brothers and sisters. It was true about the disaster. They had been laid low by the devastations of the great influenza. As with all pandemics, this struck reservations hardest. Their parents were dead, and there was no way to know where their sister had been left off, in addition to which people were afraid to catch the deadly illness and had moved away from them in haste, so that they, too, the children, were living alone. There are many stories of children who were forced to live alone, my father went on, including those stories from antiquity, in which infants were nursed by wolves. But there are also stories told from the earliest histories of Western civilization of humans rescued by animals. One of my favorites was related by Herodotus
and concerns Orion of Methymna, the famous harp player and inventor of the dithyrambic measure. This Orion got a notion to travel to Corinth and hired a boat sailed by Corinthians, his own people, whom he thought trustworthy, which just